yeah. So our last talk of the weekend is given by Bill Martin here, and he'll be telling us all about the oldie worldie revolution. Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Mike. Hang on, I'm just going to get nearer to the microphone. I've had a bit of a cold over the last week or so, so I'm going to have to use the mic so I don't have to project too much. So hopefully everyone can hear me, and it's working fine.
Yes.
Magic, thank you very much. Also means I can cough away from the mic. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to start off with a bit of a defence of my subject. I think that's normally how I start my talks, because I normally, as Mike will attest to, just try and crowbar whatever I want to talk about into the theme of the event. And this year I had to do a bit more crowbarring than normal, as Mike had to be back a couple of times. But in the end, I think this is a good thing, because I think that it helped me refine quite how my subject is actually quite relevant. And I think thematically, even though my talk is the historical one that looks backwards, in the context of the spread of talks throughout today, this weekend, I think it's fitting that it comes at the end. And hopefully it will leave people feeling actively hopeful. And so what I want to look at, I'm going to talk briefly about why I think that looking backwards to medieval events is actually particularly relevant and helpful to the socialist movement and to socialists. And then I'm going to look at some of the events of the 13th century. And I'm going to try, I've been asked to not do it in forms of, you know, one event after another, which, to be honest with you, I couldn't do anyway, because I forget dates, I'm terrible with them at the best of times. So it's going to be kind of more a case of just a series of stories, which will hopefully entertain you as much as anything else, with our big picture screen here, complete with CGI and all these special effects that your imaginations can bring together. This is going to be, although I wanted to avoid mentioning Game of Thrones, it has kind of crept its way into this talk, rather forced its way in. So think of this as your Game of Thrones morning, sadly without dragons or nudity. Well, I could do the nudity if you really want. So I'm going to look at a character called Will Withers, or Will Wither, who is a bold bandit. And then I'm going to look at the rather less bold character of Henry III. And my final character is a guy called Thomas FitzThomas, who I consider to be something of a forgotten bourgeois revolutionary, who should possibly be remembered for his role in the London Commune and the events of the Second Barons' War. This is as thrilling as that actually sounds. And I'm then going to look at the end, how the events of the Second Barons' War relate to class struggle and relate to how we got to where we are today, and hopefully, therefore, in its own way, relate to how we go forward in the future. So, I think my main defence of my talk is that we are historical materialists. As a party, as an organisation, we understand that material events driven by history have brought us to where we are today. And that as socialists, we rely very much on that theory of that there have been different forms of society, there have been different modes of production, and there have been successive revolutions throughout history. And that forms part of the basis for us maintaining, if this society has been made through politics, through revolution, then it can be remade through politics and through revolution. And that there are people in society today who would do their damnedest to help us try and forget that. But I think also, just in its very essence, imagining how people can and have lived differently is part and parcel of imagining how we can and will live differently. And we don't have to just look at contemporary anthropology, although we've had plenty of talks at these events where we have looked at contemporary anthropology and how people live today. Looking backwards at how people lived here in the past, I think adds something. And it also adds a certain objectivity, because some of these things are no longer part of hot contemporary debates as such, and we can look at the difference between how we live and how they lived, and also we could maybe see somewhere some of the propaganda creeps in, and I address some of this a bit more in the special publication for my little essay in there. So I'm not going to try and not repeat everything I say in that. And so the other thing is that we suffer from, as Marx put it, the nightmare of history. That a lot of people are set up in the imagination, especially on the left, to fight the last battle. And when anyone talks about revolution, their first thought is the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, which were very much in the same mode as the events I'm going to describe today. They were bourgeois revolutions within a fading feudalism. And that I would maintain, and we would maintain very strongly, that what we think, understand by revolution is something entirely different. And we need to explain that these revolutions were bourgeois, that they were, normally, incidentally, as kind of the party style manual says, we don't use the word bourgeoisie too much because it sounds a bit poncy and confusing. But in this case, I'm literally talking about burghers, about the city dwellers, and their revolution. So I think it's quite relevant. And of course, the bourgeois no longer is coterminous with capitalist. I think that's useful to mention. And finally, I think just because, even though I tried to keep Game of Thrones out of this talk and these elements, the fact that it has thrust its way into popular consciousness, in a very annoying way, and it's kind of the continuation of bourgeois ideology of this was feudalism, this was all wrong, it was all evil, we stand against it, aren't you glad you don't live in feudalism anymore? And it's part of the cover-up of their revolution and of their maintenance of the status quo. And to a certain extent, occasionally I follow some medievalists on Twitter, there's hot contests at the moment about medievalism, especially in America, where it's part and parcel of the discourses around race. You know, people of colour going into medievalism classes will find themselves met with stares and going, what are you doing here? And of course, medievalism, the whole world had a medieval period. And at the time we're talking about here, the centre of civilization, of world civilization, was China and India. That's where most of the people were, that's where the culture was, that's where the history really was. And Europe was an intellectual and cultural backwater. And England was a particularly barbarous example thereof. And I think picking apart some of these things is also useful for getting away from the kind of like the colonialist mindset that, you know, we discovered the world in the 15th century. You know, there were people there beforehand, and people have been living their lives, you know, essentially peasantry in England lived the same way from the Roman era right up into the 17th century. You know, people lived in their mud huts and didn't have much by way of material culture. They farmed the land. You know, that's how we lived exactly the same as the vast majority of people elsewhere in the world lived. And it's that effort of imagination, I think, that's useful to try and bring out from looking at these medieval stories rather than breaking slightly away from the list of kings. And I realise I'm telling a story about kings, but the kings were so central to life that it's really quite hard to escape from the buggers. Right. So, scroll up the CGI in your minds. I'm going to tell you the story, The Ballad of Will Wither. Robert de Thweng, it's written Thweng, but I believe it's pronounced Twang, and Twang is a town in Austria, inherited Kilton Castle in the wapentake of Langbar, around about the 1230s of the Common Era. So he was a minor baronet who lived in that area. His dad had been the chief justice of the Northern Air. And, you know, he's not a significant noble, just a run-of-the-mill knight of the shires. And he's quite excited. He's inherited this castle through his wife, and she's the niece of the former occupant of Kilton Castle. Kilton doesn't exist anymore, but the castle, there's slight ruins there, but they're on private land, so you can't get to them. And he discovers, when he takes over the estate, that the previous owner had given away the advowson of Kirkleatham, Now, an advowson was the right to appoint the parish priest, and Kirkleatham is a village. It's still there and very well preserved, just outside Redcar in the northeast. So he was very, very angry about this. What had happened, and this is a bit of a Blackadder moment, as the previous owner of Kilton Castle had laid dying, Prior Mark from Gisborough Priory had come along and told him he was going to go and burn in hell, and the way he could avoid burning in hell was to give his wealth to the priory. And so this advowson, which was worth a couple of quid a year, was handed over. Now, at the time, it seems that feudal magnates were collecting advowsons, and it wasn't just for the money. It was also so that they could give jobs to their mates. It's about being able to have patronage and power. So he was furious, angry, and he felt that he had been significantly robbed. And he tried to appeal this through the ecclesiastical courts, and the ecclesiastical courts said, well, the previous guy put it in his will and he's given it to us. So, you know, he was asking the church to give back property that had been given to the church. No wonder he felt that it was a little bit on the unfair side. So he did the only reasonable thing that anyone would do in that situation. He changed his name to Will Wither, got himself a band of brave fellows, and started raiding Gisborough Priory, taking their goods for himself. And, according to the legend, I've no idea how anyone gets any proof of this. Apparently he robbed the rich and gave to the poor. I suspect he considered himself to be something of a poor knight. This is, I should add, all going on before there's any recorded instances of the myth of Robin Hood. So I'm not saying that this is a precursor story. I'm thinking that more likely that there were plenty such stories kicking around under Henry III. And that this character was not acting entirely out of character for a minor feudal baronet with access to a castle. Of course, it was, you know, he wasn't hunted down, he wasn't killed. He was backed by the feudal magnates, so the Neville family, the De Bruce family. Obviously, De Bruce is they own lots of land on Teesside, and Robert De Bruce, the famous, you know, Scots leader, owned a lot of Yorkshire, and the Percy family as well. So the big northern magnates really backed him up on this. And eventually the king heard his case, and because Richard, Duke of Cornwall, was on his side, he sent him to beg forgiveness of the Pope. He had previously been excommunicated by the papal legate in England. And we don't know what happened. We know that later on he got arrested again for attacking a priest. So we know that his love of the church never really abated. And he might have taken Henry's side during the Barons' Wars. So this is just a little vignette, and you can imagine a bit of clashing of swords and horse hooves raiding a tithe barn and carrying off with some of the ill-gotten rents and loot that the priory had. But I think it's also, I inserted it at the start of the talk as a way of introducing some of the key concepts when considering feudalism. And actually, I've been a bit lucky. If you go around the common room area, there's some posters on the wall where some students have done some sort of contrast poster between the transition from feudalism to mercantilism. And, you know, I have some quibbles with some of the things they write, but they're actually very good little posters, and so I would recommend people, in a bit of spare time we have after this talk, going along and taking a look at them. So, just the ways that this illustrates feudal relations, feudalism is based on surplus extraction. So that basically, your landed peasants are like a beehive that you go along, you just take whatever you can take from them, to the point where you leave them just alive, and you take movable wealth away. And that, basically, the feudalism is about getting control and access to that movable wealth. And there's two ways of doing this. One is through sheer obligation. So a feudal tenant has to pay rent to their lord, and the lord sets this. Or through banditry, through sheer force of arms, raiding, taking away loot and looting, and all of these things. The important thing is, it's not reciprocal, and it's very weird. You read some Americans, they would write about feudalism as if there was some sort of reciprocity. You had to give your rent to the lord, but he would protect you. And that was the kind of like there was some sort of social contract involved. No, you gave your rent to the Lord because it was his rent, and you owed it to him. And there was the hierarchy going all the way up to the king of these obligations. And they were not two-way obligations in any sense. Eric Hobsbawm, in some of his writings, he's working on primitive rebels and on banditry, notes that banditry is the first response of peasant rebellion. The way that peasants take to rebellion is they run to the hills and then they come down and raid and they strike back against the illegitimate authorities. But as in this case, we can see that this guy turned to banditry. He was not a peasant. But the basis of that sort of approach of taking up banditry, which in the case of Mao Zedong's favourite novel, The Water Margin, the peasant bandits end up becoming the new emperor.
Oh, that's great, Water Margin. I've got it. All yeah. 64 episodes.
I was referring to the original book. But yes, even still, the great teleseries that stems from it. It ends up where the peasants eventually become, because the whole point is that they're then extracting the surplus. And however you extract the surplus, and not surplus value, we have to make that distinction. If you're the one, abstractly, you're the one in charge of the feudal relation. And I think the other thing that this incident illustrates is the difference between rebellion and revolution. So Robert de Thouars, he was a rebel, clearly. He stood up against the authorities of the day, the injustices. But there's clearly no attempt on his part to change that structure. And in fact, he was working very much within the violent, arms-driven mechanisms of a feudal society. Sorry, brief pause there for the tape, as I take a sip of water. So,
excuse me, was that a water margin then?
Oh, he's
awful. That's it. I'm gonna have to go. I can't top that.
I think
so. Now, for the real Game of Thrones, there's a slightly different story. As the second, and I know that in my little piece I've put in for the programme, I just say the Barons' War, but this is the second Barons' War. The first one was against King John, and saw Magna Carta being signed. And essentially, it's the second Barons' War was a continuation of the same, and it was all about Magna Carta. Because what had happened was John had very firmly asserted his right to personal rule, to rule as a king alone, to raise taxation by his will alone, to do what he wanted. And, of course, he'd needed a lot of money. And I'm going to come back to the effect of John. And John had died of dysentery quite suddenly. He'd actually managed quite a decent long reign before then, 10 or 12 years, which doesn't make him the shortest reign. But that meant his son came in quite young. And Henry III was a hot-tempered young man. And I don't think, by the sounds of any of my reading, a particularly useful or clever king. And he didn't clearly manage his patronage very well, shall we say. So he'd got himself into trouble. He'd had to clear out his dad's, when he reached maturity, he'd clear out his dad's old advisors, bring in the people he wanted to run things for himself. And he kind of wanted to play on the world stage. His dad had lost lots of land in France, and Henry wanted it back. And so by 1258, he's desperate for money, and he's having to try all sorts of clever tricks. So he doesn't appoint bishops. He holds back the appointments of some bishops so they keep on collecting their salaries into his coffers. He heavily taxed the Jews, that they will sadly figure again in this story in a bit of a while. I'm sure you can guess what happens to them. And then he gets embroiled in European politics, and the Pope wants to run some sort of adventure in Sicily, and threatens to excommunicate Henry unless he plays his part by sending an army. And of course, Henry hasn't got any money anymore. He's skint, and he's desperately trying to struggle around for some more. And then kind of the last sort of hammer blow, this is the kind of like the context of rebellion, is that there's a small war with the Welsh. And although Edward, his son, is supposed to be in charge of the March of Barons and defending keeping the Welsh in check, he's losing. And, you know, Henry's facing the prospect of having to intervene himself. And I don't think relations between him and his son were particularly cordial, as we shall come on to. So this is kind of the context of a serious rebellion. Also, there was a lot of ambition among the feudal magnates. Henry was having to appease them to try and keep them on side. And one of the factors of that was that he was therefore having to ignore abuses at the local level against the county knights. So they were very unpopular in the country in general. But the thing that sparked it off was yet another advowson. And it's interesting, I think, fascinating that this one kind of small feature of the system of the ability to appoint priests was so coveted. So what happened was an English knight objected that someone else had snatched his right to give an advowson. There was a clash of arms between servants, and one guy's servant got killed and a few more got injured. And the bishop involved was French, or at least not English, and there was a feeling that Henry was taking the side of this foreign-born cleric. This led into a hot confrontation where there was a parliament. Parliaments were still a relatively new thing. They'd been called under John, and it was agreed that basically he had to call together the knights of the realm, the barons, who would grant him the right to raise taxes. So he wanted a parliament in order to raise this taxation money. But then this small local grievance came before it. And this is the sort of thing that happened in pretty much all the other great revolutions, the English Revolution of the 17th century, the French Revolution. The need to call the parliament becomes the point at which the king gets ambushed. And eventually, and all sorts of latent grievances come to light. So what happened on the 30th of April, 1258, was that a bunch of knights came in full armour, surrounded by a band of retainers, and although, this is our big Game of Thrones moment, they come to the presence of the king, they take their swords off, because you're not allowed to go armed into the presence of the king. But the fact that they were there with retainers in full armour, Henry wasn't that stupid, and he said to them, what am I, poor wretch, your prisoner? And they said, well, no, you don't have to be our prisoner if you just get rid of these alien advisers and take our advice from now on, and we will be your friends.
What an offer.
It was an offer he couldn't refuse. So this led, they appointed this parliament appointed a council of 24 councillors, and they were going to look at some serious reforms of the political situation. They held, not long afterwards, another parliament at Oxford, and this led to the Provisions of Oxford, whereby Henry was compelled to appoint a chancellor, there was going to be a council of 15 barons, and essentially this was a political revolution. The king had been dethroned in all but name, and he was subject to all sorts of a new politics, which is essentially at least the formal situation we have now. We still have a monarch in England, and nominally they are in complete charge of everything. It's just that they happen to take the advice of their Prime Minister and act on the advice of the Prime Minister. They're not allowed to not take the advice, but the monarch has to live by the advice. But this is a long time ago, a very early strike for this sort of idea. This was followed up by the Provisions of Westminster in 1259, which is, again, so this new political force had come into being, and very like subsequent revolutions of this sort, they couldn't quite work out how to deal with the king. They couldn't, they couldn't execute him, they couldn't depose him, because he is the anointed of God. He has to stay in charge, so they have to kind of work around this situation. And of course, like Charles, like Louis, Henry spun things out and went, well, as long as I stay alive and in post, I can fight back a little bit later on and I can reclaim my rights as king. And of course, this has been one of the first times that anyone has come up and challenged royal authority in this way. They didn't really know what they were doing. They were playing it by ear. And of course, the central cabal, the leader of this revolution, or this revolt, was Simon de Montfort, and you can see his name all over the country, his various bits of the country around Leicester lay claim to the de Montfort legacy. But Henry held on and he was able to string things out, but then gradually claim back authority and undermine, because for all the rights and wrongs of what they were trying to redress, they weren't redressing them fast enough. So the Knights of the Shires were going, yeah, but all these ills are still going on, there's still the local abuses, we're not getting what we want. So again, like many revolutions, you know, the population at large, the cabal that are taken over are being pressed in two directions, and the reaction is building. I just to interject, obviously, I mean, although this sounds, I mean, a lot of the time these days people would say, oh, kind of the Whiggish history of things, this is progress, this is the taming of royal power by the barons. I mean, the barons are not our friends. This is them sort of... this is sort of them trying to actually restore a prior situation, because, you know, although we see it these days as kings were, you know, by right of primogeniture, you know, the firstborn son, that they were always supremely powerful. In fact, you know, the previous kings, before the Anglo-Norman kings, they were always hemmed in by... Saxon kings were more or less elected. Now, they would usually elect the son of the previous king, because that's kind of how primogeniture ended up coming about. But this attempt by the barons was not something, some sort of popular revolt. This is an attempt by the feudal magnates to draw the king back so he's just one among their number, rather than being the absolute preeminent political power in the land. And of course they can't replace the king, because kings are the anointed of God. So, by 1263, Henry has managed to get a papal bull dispensing him from his oath to obey the provisions of Oxford. And this basically reignites the whole situation, because now he's just overturned all the work of the plotters, and this leads us to a civil war. This brings us towards the point at which our third character enters the story. And although I said it was Thomas FitzThomas, really, the first real character that we start to recognise is the London mob. So Henry has renounced the provisions, he's coming back to England. The London mob hear that Prince Edward has just gone to the Temple, the Knights Templar. See, you hear all about these people who are in the popular stories, and he robs the Temple, because there's lots of movable wealth there and they need money to fight a war. Edward had been a bit estranged from his father. At various times he's either on the side of the plotters or on the side of his father, switching backwards and forwards. So the London mob come out, armed from their houses. They chase the Queen out of London, and Edward is disinclined to forget that. And then, I'm not interested in the history of warfare, so you're glad to hear I'm not going to take you through the details of long battles and details of, you know, who put what unit where. This stuff is freely available if anyone wants to find out about medieval battles. I'm sure you can find the books that you want. But the upshot was that there's two significant battles I care about. One is the Battle of Lewes, which the Montfortians won, which saw Henry captured, and then having to come again to the question of what do we do about Henry, and basically this time starting to really threaten him with execution or deposition or all sorts of things to try and rein him back in. And then the final thing that sorted it all out was the Battle of Evesham in 1265, which saw Simon de Montfort killed. And rather significantly, Henry was very badly wounded in the same battle. And I think that don't really want to emphasise the battles, because the clear point that the actors in this story were actually in the fights themselves. They weren't you know, commanders sitting behind the fields or somewhere behind sending armies out. This is a row basically between gangsters. You know, these people are trained soldiers, and that's how they've lived their lives. And, you know, if you look at the life of Edward I, I don't think he ever was off the battlefield. So just a necessary aside, because the Jews do figure significantly in the story. So Henry had taxed them quite heavily. And as I'm sure this is fairly common knowledge at the time, because of basic prejudice against them, they weren't allowed to enter into trades or professions. They weren't allowed to own land. So they were compelled in their own way to becoming the moneylenders. This is how they were seen. And not all of them were, obviously, the moneylenders, but obviously this is how they were perceived, that people owed money to the Jews. And this became a kind of important rallying point. Now, the Jews were owned by the king. Officially, the king tolerated them and allowed them because they were allowed to charge usury on Christians because other Christians weren't allowed to. That was the official thing. I mean, I'm sure that the Knights Templar, who were also operating a banking operation, hence why they were robbed as well, were not above charging a bit of interest. And, you know, the history of banking and interest is obviously one of not a barefaced hypocrisy a lot of the time. But the Jews were the property of the king, so Montfort went along and said, well, OK, he's taxing them heavily, what I'll do is I will free you from your debts to the Jews, I will reduce them. And then other people had a much brighter and easier idea of how to reduce their debts to the Jews, and in Worcester, Cambridge and London, they massacred them, rather horrifically. And in London, around 500 were killed. But this is, again, part and parcel of the way of feudalism working. It doesn't work through reciprocity. It works through the physical capture of portable wealth. And at this point, the Jewish moneylenders were a part and parcel of the portable wealth. And I think David Graeber, in his Debt for the First 5,000 Years, notes that King Henry and his brother Richard of Cornwall were not above torturing the Jews quite horribly to try and get money out of them. To get them to say where it was. So, on both sides. And, of course, the whole revolt was latent with this latent xenophobia. And, of course, the Jews took part and parcel of that horrifying instance. And just as a note, the character coming up, Thomas FitzThomas, can claim at least some credit for arranging Jews and other foreigners sanctuary in the Tower of London when the riots and the pogroms started. So, to turn to London itself, London was at this point an ancient continuous settlement. It had certainly been a significant city when the Normans had arrived and prior to that. And at the time of the cities in Britain that anyone in Europe would have heard of, London, Bristol, York and Edinburgh would be the only four that were of any note. I mean, you know, York was once the centre of the Roman Empire, so, you know, that's why that gets mentioned. But London had patched itself onto the cause of the barons during the First Barons' War, and seeking in Magna Carta to gain significant rights. And in fact, there are entire clauses of Magna Carta dedicated to the rights and liberties of London. So this was the significant catch. It was clearly striving to replicate the status of the European communes, which were essentially, the commune was almost like its own self-governing statelet, and the Italian cities would have been, whereas London itself was part of the king's demesne, which meant that the king could personally tax it without having to ask anyone else's permission, and that there were all sorts of issues with that, because they didn't like being taxed. Again, this is back to portable surplus wealth. Here we have the trading city is seen as a cash pot for the feudal king. And in fact, John had granted commune status to other cities in England and had been very keen in promoting markets because he wanted cash, and markets generated cash that he could then tax and turn into wealth to pay for mercenaries to shore up his power. And of course, London had significant liberties. It was exempt from tolls and all sorts of things. So it had got to itself to be a very significant city within the politics of England. And the aldermen and mayor and sheriffs of London saw themselves and asserted themselves as the equal of barons, and in fact styled themselves as barons. And they said, "Well, we're barons, just like the real ones. We shouldn't be tried before the king. We should be tried before our peers, as Magna Carta lays down." So, I mean, London had been exempt from all sorts of things, like the murder fine. So everywhere else, if there was a murder of a Norman, you know, near a Saxon village, the entire village had to pay for it, and this sort of thing. And that had been part and parcel of the way in which the Normans had spread their power. And London was itself divided. It was ruled by some old families. The aldermen, it seems that this at some point were basically hereditary groups, and it moves much more by the time of the events of the 1260s we're talking about, that they were, the aldermen were elected. But there were also significant controls on who could be a guild, or the crafts and mysteries, as they referred to themselves. And so there were numerous crafts, lesser crafts, that didn't have power, that weren't allowed to call themselves mysteries, that weren't allowed to organise and receive official recognition. And things like the vintners and the drapers basically ruled London. And the king was able to play this off because he could rely on people by giving them royal appointments. So if he could give them a job in the palace and give them royal positions, so that these people who felt that they were significant on a national stage were also significantly tied in the ruling clique of London with the king. And the king was their number one customer. So this is one of the, so that's why the vintners and the drapers managed to rule so much, because the king was buying lots of wine and lots of wool. So the king tried to, Henry was desperate for money, and he had tried to raise the taxes. And London argued that they didn't pay taxes. They gave the king aid. So that their taxes were a voluntary contribution to the king. And the exchequer wrote back and said, no, it's a tax. And the Londoners were very unhappy with this. And the aldermen eventually said, look, well, this is the final assertion. This needs to be sorted in the court, and this needs to be before a trial of our peers, not before you. You don't have any rights as a king. We are a bunch of barons, and we should be dealt with as a bunch of barons. So, and I think this is one of those significant things, a bit like a lot of revolutions that you hear about. Henry played a bit of a blinder and resurrected an old popular form of control. He summoned the folk moot. And the folk moot was used to remove the then mayor and the alderman and all sorts of people who were accused of corruption. He would live to regret summoning the folk moot, because, of course, this opened up to the various lower classes and the people excluded by the normal politics of London back into the London affairs. At the time, when that happened, Thomas FitzThomas was the Sheriff of London, and although he was deposed with them, he was not himself implicated in any corruption himself, and he was restored to office the following year, as soon as things cleared up. And what Henry kept doing was he kept suspending the liberties of London and then charging them lots of money to get them back. So they were not. There was this tension between themselves and the king at this point. So by the time of 1263, Edward's raided the temple, the London mob have risen. Thomas FitzThomas by then is the mayor of London, and he basically places himself at the head of the London revolt. Now, he was actually from a draper's family. He was a draper himself. He was clearly part of the alderman class, and part of the old regime. His uncle had been a quite conservative mayor. What happened next was quite surprising, which was that Thomas then summoned the folk moot. And the folk moot was used to basically bypass the machinery of the government of London and handed London into the hands of the excluded crafts and the excluded mysteries, who wanted basically to get their position within, and who felt that they had been on the receiving end of injustice. And of course, one of the things that happened as part of the Mockfordian Revolution was they sent Hugh Bigod as a justiciar into London, and he held lots of cases very rapidly and solved lots of long-running disputes, or at least resolved them, not necessarily correctly, by proper due process. But that this led to a lot of people being very angry because they'd been found against. But this was suddenly starting to appeal to the middling sort, the excluded sort of the London city, who had been held back by the old regime. So this put London very succinctly in the side of the Mockfordians. FitzThomas summoned everyone together and made everyone over the age of 12 swear an oath. to take them up for the insider that they armed the citizenry. So this is the point at which most Leninists wet themselves. What they've summoned a revolutionary council, they've armed the citizenry, they've taken oaths, and they're standing against the king. I mean, this is the classic revolution as we would all understand it. And, you know, so this guy, this is the English Lenin. Him and his mate John de Stepney, which I think is a great name, de Stepney. And then so FitzThomas took an oath with the Mopfordians and swore to take their side. And this is where things start to unravel for London. They send a group of men to join the Mopfordian forces. Now, these are city dwellers. These are not trained and practiced soldiers by any stretch of the imagination. And just as a slight aside, I think it's in my little essay, David Graeber in his book talks about capitalism being the alliance of the mercantile and the martial classes. But, of course, in many ways, at this point in English history, the peasantry are as much a martial class as the aristocracy. The peasants formed the backbone of the levies, and it was very lucrative to go off to fight the wars on the behalf of the feudal magnates and come back with a bit of the loot in your pocket, as much as anyone else. So, you know, they sort of like Monty Python, you know, they're a peasant because they're covered in shit type thing. It doesn't really apply. They were every much as part of this feudal system of fighting for wealth. And of course that meant that, you know, because the peasants would go and train and practice, and the men of London didn't. So come the Battle of Lewes, Prince Edward, now fighting on his father's side, spots the men of London. And he remembers that they had attacked his mother, that the mob had come out against him. And so he goes and he kills the men of London on the battlefield of the Battle of Lewes. Now, Henry's side actually loses the battle overall, but the losses for the Londoners were horrific. And I think there's an object lesson there. And so London continued on it on the side of the Montfortians right up until the death of Simon de Montfort and the Battle of Evesham. And then after that, they don't have any military wherewithal to resist Henry III returning to London. And he is in no mood for taking prisoners. Well, he's in plenty of mood for taking prisoners because that's what he does. He arrests FitzThomas and imprisons him. London is basically sacked. Lots of people are given restitution. People are depossessed of the wealth. People have to run away. People in other towns were arrested for being a Londoner. Somewhere, I think it's in Nottingham, someone was arrested for having visited London. That is taking reprisals to the fullest extent. But basically, and ultimately, Edward I was to take revenge by moving his wine buying away from London. He would buy it through the French and not buy through the London vintners as a means of punishing them. So this brings me to kind of like the final section. I've gone on for a bit of a while here. The political points I was raising. So, yeah, I've already mentioned the kind of like the Whiggish idea of progress, that this was the first strike in the battle to try and tame the king that we eventually see in the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Well, I think at this time it's the barons trying to hold back, that they're being reactionary. In fact, in many ways, at this point, if we're being objective Marxists about it, it's the king that's the progressive force, because it's the king that is going to bring about the marketisation and bring about the pre-capitalist situation. And ultimately, as I mentioned many years ago in a different talk, it was in fact Edward I and his need to raise money to pay for the mercenaries for his wars that saw the start to the move of clearing peasants off the land for sheep, for wool, to sell wool, to make coin and foreign trade that eventually leads to the further commodification of society. So this is kind of like these events are at the very birth pangs of capitalism and very deeply within the old feudalism. And I think that, you know, so when we all the time in, you know, things like Game of Thrones, the king is always the bad guy, and because there's this kind of liberal remembrance. The king was the bad guy. We got rid of the king. That was their revolution. When in fact, at this point, although they were siding against the king early on, because they were going to always end up having to get rid of him, at this point, it really was that they were siding with some very conservative elements to do this. But by doing so, that they were asserting a political identity and a political demand for equality, to be treated as if they were a part of the rest of the polity with the barons and the knights and the kings. And I think that is significant. And there's also an element which, because London was representing itself as the liberties of the cities, of the urban folk, the first inklings of the bourgeoisie proper as a class and engaging in this was routine class struggle, but it was routine class struggle in a society that wasn't based around the struggle over, as Howard was saying last night, the struggle over surplus value. It was a society based on the struggle over surplus, where the primary mechanism was violence. And the kind of like the lesson here was that this was not a decadent feudalism. The king was still in the field himself. The king was a fighter. They were all experienced and very accomplished warriors. De Montfort died quite bravely, because he could have taken refuge in the nearby abbey. He could have run away, but he thought that's neither chivalrous nor noble. And he said, OK, we're outnumbered. We're going to make a fight of this. And the fact that they nearly killed the king shows that it was savage war to the knife to the end. So what hopefully I've showed you there is that the class struggle, the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie themselves, had to fight a long time to finally make the revolution. They had to fight make their class struggle and lose in the first instance. And that history is based on these sorts of political revolutions, and that there has been a very different way of living. And that we can look back to the past as a means of looking forward to the future and understanding that our revolution, even if we don't win today, we can take the fight forward to tomorrow. Thank you very much.